I lean back in the patio chair and stare at the jungle gym that will hopefully start to take shape soon. As I stare at it, I think of Scotty. This is exactly why I tore it down. Scotty and I smoked our first cigarette in that jungle gym, I say to Patrick. We were 13. Patrick laughs and leans back in his chair. He seems relieved that I've changed the subject. Where did you two get cigarettes at 13? My dad's truck. Patrick shakes his head. We drank our first beer there. We got high for the first time there. And if I remember correctly, Scotty had his first kiss there. Who was she? Patrick asks. Dana Freeman. She lived down the street. She was my first kiss, too. That was the only fight me and Scotty ever got into. Who kissed her first? I did. Scotty swooped in like a fucking eagle and took her from me. Pissed me off. But not because I liked her. I just didn't like that she chose him over me. We didn't speak for like 8 whole hours. Well, it's only fair. He was so much better looking than you. I laugh. Patrick sighs, and now we're both thinking about Scotty, and it's bringing the energy down. I hate how often this happens. I wonder if it'll ever start to happen less. Do you think Scotty wished I was different? Patrick asks. What do you mean? You were a great dad. I've worked in an office crunching sales figures my whole life. Sometimes I wondered if he ever wished I was something better, like a firefighter or an athlete. I wasn't the type of dad he could brag about. I feel bad that Patrick thinks Scotty would have wanted him to be any different than he was. I think back to the many conversations Scotty and I had about our future, and one of those conversations sticks out to me. Scotty never wanted to move away, I said. He wanted to meet a girl and have kids and take them to the movies every weekend and to Disney World every summer. I remember thinking he was crazy when he said that because my dreams were way bigger. I told him I wanted to play football and travel the world and own businesses and have a steady cash flow. I wasn't about the simple life like he was. I say to Patrick. I remember, after I told him how important I wanted to be, he said, I don't want to be important. I don't want the pressure. I want to slide under the radar like my dad, because when he comes home at night, he's in a good mood. Patrick is quiet for a while, but then he says, You're full of shit. He never said that. I swear, I say with a laugh. He said things like that all the time. He loved you just the way you were. Patrick leans forward and stares at the ground, clasping his hands together. Thank you for that. Even if it isn't true. It's true, I say, reassuring him. But Patrick still seems sad. I try to think of one of the lighter stories about Scotty. One time, we were sitting inside the jungle gym, and out of nowhere, this pigeon landed in the yard. It was only 3 or 4 feet away from us. Scotty looked at it and said, Is that a fucking pigeon? And I don't know why. Maybe because we were both high. But we laughed so hard at that. We laughed until we cried. And for years, up until he died, every time we'd see something that didn't make sense, Scotty would say, Is that a fucking pigeon? Patrick laughs. That's why he always said that. I nod. Patrick starts laughing even harder. He laughs until he cries. And then he just cries. When the memories start to hit Patrick like this, I always walk away and leave him alone. He's not the type who wants comfort when he's sad. He just wants solitude. I go inside and close the door, wondering if it'll ever get better for him and Grace. It's only been 5 years, but will he still need to cry alone in 10 years? 20? I want so badly for them to heal, but the loss of a child is a wound that never heals. It makes me wonder if Kenna cries like Patrick and Grace do. Did she feel that kind of loss when they took Diem from her? Because if she did, I can't imagine Grace and Patrick would willingly allow her to continue to feel it, since they know what it feels like firsthand.
Chapter 17. Kenna. Dear Scotty, I started my new job today. I'm here now, actually. I'm at orientation and it's really boring. I'm 2 hours into videos about how to properly bag groceries, stack eggs, keep meats separated, and I'm trying to keep my eyes open, but I haven't been sleeping well. Luckily, I figured out that the orientation videos still play if I minimize the video tab. I'm writing you this letter using Microsoft Word. I used the printer here to print off all the old letters I typed into Google Docs when I was in prison. I shoved them into my bag and put them in my employee locker to hide them, because I doubt I'm supposed to be printing things. Almost everything I remember about you is documented. Every important conversation we had. Every impactful moment that happened after you died. I spent 5 years typing letters to you, trying to recall all the memories I had with you in case DM wants to know about you someday. I know your parents have more to share with her about you than I do, but I still feel like the part of you I knew is worth sharing. When I was walking around downtown the other day, I noticed the antique store was no longer there. It's a hardware store now. It made me think of the first time we went there and you bought me all those tiny little rubber hands. We were a few days from our 6-month anniversary, but we were celebrating it early because I had to work the weekend shift and wouldn't get off work in time for us to go out. We'd both said I love you by that point. We were past our first kiss, our first time to make love, our first fight. We had just eaten at a new sushi restaurant downtown and were browsing antique stores, mostly window shopping because it was still light out. We were holding hands, and every now and then you would stop and kiss me. We were in that sickening stage of relationships, the stage I'd never reached with anyone before you. We were happy, in love, full of hormones, full of hope. It was bliss, a bliss we thought would last forever. You pulled me into the antique store at one point during our walk and said,
"Pick something out. I'll buy it for you."
"I don't need anything."
"This isn't about you. It's about me, and I want to buy you something."
I knew you didn't have a lot of money. You were about to graduate college, and you planned to start graduate school full-time. I was still working at Dollar Days, making minimum wage. So I walked toward the jewelry display, hoping I could find something cheap. Maybe a bracelet or a pair of earrings. But it was a ring that caught my eye. It was dainty and gold, and it looked like it belonged on the finger of someone straight out of the 1800s. There was a pink stone in the center of it. You noticed the moment I spotted it, because I sucked in a breath.
"You like that one?"
you asked. It was in a case with all the other rings. So you asked the guy behind the counter if we could see it. The man took it out and handed it to you. You slipped it on the ring finger of my right hand and it fit perfectly. "It's so pretty," I said. It was honestly the prettiest ring I'd ever seen.
"How much is it?"
you asked the guy.
$4,000. I could probably knock a couple hundred off. It's been in the case for a few months."
Your eyes bulged at that price.
$4,000?
You asked in disbelief.
"Is it a fucking pigeon?"
I sputtered laughter because I had no idea why you always said that phrase, but it was at least the third time I'd heard you say it. I also laughed because the ring was $4,000 freaking. I'm not sure I'd ever had anything on my body worth $4,000. You grabbed my hand and said,
"Hurry, take it off before you break it."
You gave it back to the man. There was a display of tiny rubber hands next to the register. They were little gag gifts that slipped onto the tips of fingers so you'd have 50 fingers instead of 10. You grabbed one and said,
"How much are these?"
The man said,
$2.
You bought me 10 of them, one for each finger. It was the stupidest gift anyone had ever given me, but by far my favorite. When we stepped out of the store, we were both laughing.
$4,000,
you muttered, shaking your head.
Does that ring come with a car? Do all rings cost that much? Do I need to start saving for our engagement now?
You were slipping the rubber hands on the tips of my fingers as you ranted about the price of jewelry. But your rant made me smile, because it's the first time you ever mentioned the word engagement. I think you noticed what you said because you got quiet after that. When all the rubber hands were on my fingers, I touched both of your cheeks. It looked so ridiculous. You were smiling when you wrapped your hands around my wrists and kissed my palm. Then you kissed the palms of all 10 of my rubber hands. I have so many fingers now, I said. How will you afford to buy rings for all 50 of my fingers? You laughed and pulled me against you.
I'll figure out a way. I'll rob a bank. Or I'll rob my best friend. He'll be rich soon, that lucky bastard.
You were referring to Ledger, although I'm not sure I knew that at the time, because I didn't know Ledger. He had just signed a contract with the Broncos. I knew very little about sports, though, and nothing about your friends. We were consumed by each other so much we hardly made time for anyone else. You were in class most days, and I worked most days, so the little time we were able to spend together, we spent together alone. I figured that would eventually change. We were just at points in our lives where we were each other's priority, and neither of us saw that as a bad thing because it felt so good. You pointed at something in the window of the store across the street, and then you grabbed one of the tiny plastic cans and you held it as we headed in that direction. I had this fantasy that you would someday propose to me, and then we'd get married and have babies and raise them together in this town because you loved it here, and I would have loved anywhere you wanted to be. But you died, and we didn't get to live out our dream. And now we never will, because life is a cruel, cruel thing, the way it picks and chooses who to bully. We're given these shitty circumstances and told by society that we too can live the American dream. But what they don't tell us is that dreams almost never come true. It's why they call it the American dream, rather than the American reality. Our reality is that you're dead. I'm in orientation for a shitty job making minimum wage, and our daughter is being raised by people who aren't us. Reality is depressing as fuck. So is this job. I should probably get back to it. Love, Kenna. Amy put me on the floor after I finished the 3 hours of orientation videos. I was nervous at first because I was expecting to shadow someone my first day. But Amy said, "Make sure the heavy stuff goes on the bottom. Treat the bread and eggs like infants and you'll be fine." She was right. I've been bagging groceries and carrying them out for customers for 2 hours now, and so far, it's just your average low-paying job. No one warned me there could be job hazards on the first day, though. That job hazard is named Ledger. And even though I haven't laid eyes on him, I just spotted his ugly orange truck in the parking lot. My pulse speeds up because I don't want him to make a scene. I haven't seen him since he showed up at my apartment Saturday night to check on me. I think I handled myself pretty well. He seemed remorseful for treating me the way he did, but I kept my cool and acted unfazed, even though his showing back up definitely fazed me. It gave me a little bit of hope. If he feels bad enough for how he treated me, maybe there's a chance he could eventually grow empathetic toward my situation. I'm sure it's a small chance, but it's still a chance. Maybe I shouldn't avoid him. Being in his presence might make him realize I'm not the monster he thinks I am. I walk back inside the store and return the grocery cart to the rack. Amy is behind the customer service counter. "Can I take a bathroom break?" "You don't have to ask permission to pee," she says. "Remember how we met? I fake pee every hour when I'm here. It's the only way I stay sane." I really like her. I don't have to use the restroom. I just want to walk around and see if I can spot Ledger. Part of me hopes he's here with Diem, but I know he isn't. He saw me applying for a job here, which means he'll likely never bring Diem inside this store ever again. I eventually find him in the cereal aisle. I was planning to just spy on him, so I can keep tabs on him while he shops. But he's at the same end of the aisle I appear at, and he spots me as soon as I see him. We're just 4 feet apart from one another. He's holding a box of Fruity Pebbles. I wonder if those are for Diem.
You got the job?
Ledger says this without any hint as to whether he even cares that I got the job, or if he's bothered by it. I'm sure if he's that bothered by it, he would have shopped somewhere else today. It's not like he didn't know I was trying to get a job here. He's going to have to find a new store if it bothers him, because I'm not going anywhere. I can't. No one else will hire me. I look up from the box of cereal in his hands and immediately wish I hadn't. He looks different today. Maybe it's the fluorescent lighting or the fact that when I'm in his presence, I'm attempting not to look at him too closely. But here in the cereal aisle, the lights seem to illuminate him. I hate that he looks better under fluorescent lighting. How is that even possible? His eyes are friendlier. His mouth is even more inviting. And I don't like that I'm thinking good things about the man who physically pulled me away from the house my daughter was in. I leave the cereal aisle with a new lump in my throat. I changed my mind. I don't want to be nice to him. He's already spent 5 years judging me. I'm not going to change his view of me in the aisle of a grocery store. And I get too flustered in his presence to give him any semblance of a good impression. I try to time things so that I'm not available when he checks out. But as karma would have it, the other grocery baggers on duty are all busy. I get called to his lane to bag his groceries, which means I'll have to walk them out to his truck and converse with him and be nice. I don't make eye contact with him, but I can feel him watching me as I separate his food into sacks. There's something intimate about knowing what everyone in this town is buying for their kitchens. I feel like I can almost define a person based on their groceries. Single women buy a lot of healthy food. Single men buy a lot of steak and frozen dinners. Large families buy a lot of bulk meat and produce. Ledger gets frozen dinners, steak, Cheshire sauce, Pringles, animal crackers, Fruity Pebbles, milk, chocolate milk, and a lot more Gatorade. Based on his selections, I conclude he's a single guy who spends a lot of time with my daughter. The last items the cashier rings up are 3 cans of SpaghettiOs. I'm jealous he knows what my daughter likes. And that jealousy shows in the way I toss the cans into the sack and then into the cart with a thud. The cashier side-eyes me as Ledger pays for the groceries. Once he gets his receipt, he folds it up and puts it in his billfold while walking to the cart.
I can get it.
I have to do it, I say flatly. Store policy. He nods and then leads the way to his truck. I don't like that I still find him attractive. I try to look everywhere but at him as we make our way across the parking lot. When I was in his bar the other night, before I knew he was the owner, I couldn't help but notice how diverse the employees were. That made me appreciate whoever the owner was. The other two bartenders, Rosie and Roman, are both black. One of the waitresses is Hispanic. I like that he's a figure in my daughter's life. I want her to be raised by good people. And even though I barely know Ledger, so far he seems like a decent human. When we reach his truck, Ledger takes the Gatorades and puts them in the back while I unload the rest of his groceries into the back seat opposite the side where Diem's booster seat is. There's a pink and white scrunchie on the floorboard. When I'm finished loading his sacks, I stare at the scrunchie for a few seconds and then reach for it. There's a strand of brown hair wrapped around it. I pull at the hair until it comes loose from the scrunchie. The strand is about 7 inches long and is the exact same color as mine. She has my hair. I feel Ledger approach me from behind, but I don't care. I want to climb into this back seat and stay here with her booster seat and her hair scrunchie and see if I can find any other remnants of her that'll give me hints as to what she looks like and what kind of life she lives. I turn around,
still staring at the scrunchie. Does she look like me? I glance up at him, and his eyebrows are drawn apart as he looks at me. His left arm is resting on the top of his truck, and I feel caged between him, the door, and the grocery cart.
Yeah, she does.
He doesn't say how she looks like me. Is it her eyes, her mouth, her hair, all of her? I want to ask him if we have similar personalities, but he doesn't know me at all. How long have you known her? He folds his arms over his chest and looks down at his feet, like he doesn't feel comfortable answering these questions.
Since they brought her home.
The jealousy that rolls through me is almost audible. I suck in a trembling breath and push back my tears with another question. What's she like? That question makes him sigh heavily.
Kenna.
All he says is my name, but it's enough to know he's done answering my questions. He looks away from me and scans the parking lot.
Do you walk to work?
Convenient change of subject. Yes. He's looking at the sky now.
It's supposed to storm this afternoon.
Lovely.
You could Uber.
His eyes come back to mine.
Did they have Uber before you?
His voice trails off. Went to prison? I finish with a roll of my eyes. Yes, Uber existed, but I don't have a phone, so I don't have the app.
You don't have a phone?
I had one, but I dropped it last month, and I can't get a new one until I get a paycheck. Someone uses a key fob to unlock the car a space over from us. I glance around and see Lady Diana walking toward the car with an older couple and a cart full of groceries. We aren't in their way, but I use it as an excuse to close his door. Lady Diana sees Ledger as she's opening the trunk. She grabs the first sack and mutters, "Jerk." It makes me smile. I glance at Ledger, and I think he might even be smiling. I don't like that he doesn't seem like an asshole. It would be a lot easier to hate him if he were an asshole. I'm keeping the scrunchie, I say as I turn the cart around. I want to tell him that if he's going to insist on shopping here, he should bring my daughter next time. But when I'm in his presence, I can't decide if I should be polite because he's the only thing linking me to my daughter, or if I should be mean because he's one of the things keeping me from my daughter. Saying nothing when I want to say everything is probably my best bet for now. I glance back at him before I head into the store, and he's still leaning against his truck, watching me. I go inside and return the cart to the rack, and then pull my hair up with DM's scrunchie and wear it for the rest of my shift.
Chapter 18. Ledger. There are a dozen chocolate cupcakes staring at me when I walk inside the bar. Damn it, Roman. Every week he goes to the bakery down the street and buys cupcakes. He only buys them so he'll have an excuse to see the woman who owns the bakery, but he doesn't even eat them, which means that leaves me with the task of eating them. I usually take the ones that survive the night to DM. I grab one of the cupcakes just as Roman walks through the double doors from the back of the bar. Why don't you just ask her out? I've put on 10 pounds since you first saw her. Her husband might not like that, Roman says. Oh yeah, she's married. Good point. I've never spoken to her, you know. I just keep buying cupcakes from her because I think she's hot. And apparently I like to torture myself. You definitely enjoy self-torture. You still work here for some reason. Exactly, Roman says flatly. He leans against the counter. So, what's the update on Kenna? I look over his shoulder. Anyone else here yet? I don't want to talk about Kenna around anyone. The last thing I need is for it to get back to the Landrys that I've interacted with her outside of the one time they know of. No. Marianne comes on at 7 and Razi is off tonight. I take a bite of the cupcake and talk with a mouthful. She works at the grocery store on Cantrell. She has no car. No phone. I'm starting to think she doesn't even have family. She walks to work. These cupcakes are fucking delicious. You should see the woman who bakes them, Roman says. Have Diem's grandparents decided what to do? I put the other half of the cupcake back in the box and wipe my mouth with a napkin. I tried talking to Patrick about it yesterday, but he doesn't even want the topic up for discussion. He just wants her out of town and out of their lives. What about you? I want what's best for Diem, I say immediately. I've always wanted what's best for Diem. I just don't know if what I used to think was best for her is still what's best for her. Roman doesn't say anything. He's staring at the cupcakes. Then he says, fuck it, and he grabs one. You think she cooks as good as she bakes? Hopefully one day I find out. Almost one out of every two couples divorce, he says, his voice hopeful. I bet Whitney could find you a nice single girl to date. Fuck you, he mutters. I'd rather wait until Cupcake Girl's marriage falls apart. Does Cupcake Girl have a name? Everyone has a name. It's the slowest night we've had in a long time, probably because it's Monday and it's raining. I don't usually notice every time the door to the bar opens, but since there are only three customers right now, all eyes go to her when she slips inside and out of the rain. Roman notices her too. We're both staring in her direction when he says, I have a feeling your life is about to get incredibly complicated, Ledger. Kenna walks toward me, her clothes soaking wet. She takes the same seat she sat in the first time she was here. She pulls Diem's scrunchie out of her hair, and then leans over the bar and grabs a handful of napkins. Well, you were right about the rain, she says, drying her face and her arms. I need a ride home. I'm confused, because the last time she got out of my truck, she was so angry with me I was positive she'd never be inside of it again. From me? She shrugs. You? An Uber? A cab? I don't care. But first I want a coffee. I hear you guys carry caramel now. She's in a feisty mood. I hand her a clean rag and start making her a coffee while she dries off. I look at the time, and it's been at least 10 hours since I was in the store. Did you just now get off work? Yeah. Someone called in, so I worked a double. The grocery store closes at 9, and it likely takes her an hour to walk home. You probably shouldn't be walking home this late. Then buy me a car, she retorts. I glance over at her, and she raises an eyebrow like that was a dare. I top her coffee with a cherry and slide it over to her. How long have you owned this bar? She asks. A few years. Didn't you used to play some kind of professional sport? Her question makes me laugh. Maybe because my short 2-year stint as an NFL player is usually the only thing people around here want to talk about with me, but Kenna makes it seem like a passing thought. Yeah. Football for the Broncos. Were you any good? I shrug. I mean, I made it to the NFL, so I didn't suck. But I wasn't good enough to get my contract renewed. Scotty was proud of you, she says. She looks down at her drink and cups her hands around it. She was pretty closed off the first night she came in, but her personality is starting to slip here and there. She eats her cherry and then takes a sip of the coffee. I want to tell her she can go upstairs to the apartment Roman stays in so she can dry her clothes, but it feels wrong being nice to her. It's been a constant battle in my head for the last couple of days, wondering how I can be attracted to someone I've hated for so long. Maybe it's because the attraction happened last Friday, before I knew who she was. Or maybe it's because I'm starting to question my reasons for having hated her for so long. You don't have friends in this town who can give you a ride home from work? Family? She sets down her coffee. I know two people in this town. One of them is my daughter, but she's only 4 and can't drive yet. The other one is you. I don't like that her sarcasm somehow makes her more attractive. I need to stop interacting with her. I don't need her to be here in this bar. Someone might see me talking to her, and word could get back to Grace and Patrick. I'll give you a ride home when you finish your coffee. I walk to the other end of the bar just to get away from her. Kenna and I head outside to my truck about half an hour later. The bar closes in an hour, but Roman said he'd take care of it. I just need to get Kenna out of the bar and out of my presence so no one can tie us together. It's still raining, so I grab an umbrella and I hold it over her. Not that it'll make a huge difference. She's still soaking wet from her walk here. I open the passenger door for her, and she climbs inside the truck. It's awkward when we make eye contact, because there's no way we aren't both thinking about the last time we were together on this side of the truck. I shut her door and try not to think about that night, or what I thought of her, or how she tasted. Her feet are against the dash when I settle into the driver's seat. She's fidgeting with Diem's hair scrunchie as I pull onto the street. I can't stop thinking about what she said. About Diem being the only person in this town she knows besides me. If that's true, Diem isn't even really someone she knows. She just knows Diem is here and that she exists. But the only person she really knows in this town is me. I don't like that. People need people. Where is her family? Where is her mother? Why has none of her family tried to reach out and get to know Diem? I've always wondered why no one, not even another grandparent or aunt or uncle, has tried contacting Grace or Patrick about meeting Diem. And if she doesn't have a cell phone, who does she talk to? Do you regret kissing me? She asks. My focus swings from the road and over to her as soon as she asks that. She's staring at me expectantly, so I look at the road again, gripping my steering wheel. I nod, because I do regret it. Maybe not for the reasons she thinks I regret it, but I regret it all the same. It's quiet all the way to her apartment after that. I put my truck in park and glance over at her. She's looking down at the scrunchie in her hand. She slides it onto her wrist, and without even making eye contact with me, she mutters, "Thanks for the ride." She opens her door and is out of my truck before I find my voice to tell her goodnight.
Chapter 19. Kenna. I think about kidnapping DM sometimes. I'm not sure why I don't follow through with it. It's not like there's a worse life for me than the one I'm currently living. At least when I was in prison, I had a reason I was unable to see my daughter. But right now, the only reason is the people raising her. And it hurts to hate the people raising her. I don't want to hate them. When I was in prison, it was harder to blame them, because I was so grateful she had people who were taking care of her. But from right here in this lonely apartment, it's hard not to think of how great it would be to take DM and go on the run. Even if it was just for a few days before I got caught, I could give her everything while I had her. Ice cream, presents, maybe a trip to Disney World. We'd have a lavish week-long celebration before I turned myself in, and she'd remember it forever. She'd remember me. And then, by the time I got out of prison for kidnapping her, she'd be an adult, and she'd probably forgive me, because who wouldn't appreciate a mother who would risk going back to prison just to experience one good week with their daughter? The only thing preventing me from taking her is the possibility that Patrick and Grace might change their minds someday. What if they have a change of heart, and I get to meet Diem without having to break the law to do it? And there's also the fact that she doesn't know me at all. She doesn't even love me. I'd be ripping her from the only parents she knows. And while that might sound appealing to me, it would more than likely be horrifying for Diem. I don't want to make selfish decisions. I want to be a good example for Diem, because someday she'll find out who I am and that I wanted to be in her life. It might be 13 years from now before she's able to decide for herself whether or not she wants anything to do with me. And for that reason alone, I'm going to live the next 13 years in a way that will hopefully make her proud. I snuggle up to Ivy and try to fall asleep, but I can't. There are so many thoughts swimming around in my head, and none of my thoughts ever settle. I've had insomnia since the night Scotty died. I spend my nights awake, thinking about Diem and Scotty. And now, thoughts of Ledger are added to the mix. Part of me is still so mad at him for intercepting me at their house this past weekend. But part of me feels a sense of hope when I'm around him. He doesn't seem to hate me. Yes, he regrets kissing me, but I don't care about that. I don't even know why I asked him that question. I just wonder if he regrets it because he was Scotty's best friend, or because of what I did to Scotty. Probably both. I want Ledger to see the side of me that Scotty saw, so that I might have someone on my side. It's really fucking lonely when the only friends you have are a teenager and a kitten. I should have made more of an effort with Scotty's mom when he was alive. I wonder if that would have made a difference. The night I met Scotty's parents was probably the strangest night of my life. I'd seen families like theirs on television, but never in person before. I honestly didn't know they existed. Parents who got along and seemed to like each other. They met us in the driveway. It had been 3 weeks since Scotty had been home, and they looked like they hadn't seen him in years. They hugged him, not like a hello hug, but an I missed you hug, a you're the best son in the world hug. They hugged me too, but it was a different hug. Quick, hello, nice to meet you hug. When we went inside the house, Grace said she needed to finish up dinner, and I know I should have told her I'd help, but I didn't know my way around a kitchen, and I was afraid she'd smell the inexperience on me. So instead, I stuck to Scotty's side like glue. I was nervous and I felt out of place, and he was the closest to a home that I could get. They even prayed. Scotty said the prayer. It was so earth-shattering for me to be sitting at a dinner table, listening to a guy thank God for his meal and his family and me. It was too surreal to keep my eyes closed. I wanted to take it all in, to see what other people looked like as they prayed. I wanted to stare at this family, because it was hard to wrap my head around the idea that if I married Scotty, this would be mine. I would have these parents, and this meal would be something I helped cook, and I'd learn how to thank God for my food and for Scotty. I wanted it. I craved it. Normalcy, something I was wholly unfamiliar with. I saw Grace peek up right at the end of the prayer, and she caught me looking around. I immediately closed my eyes, but at that point Scotty said, Amen, and everyone picked up their forks, and Grace already had an opinion of me, and I was too scared and too young to know how to change it. It seemed hard for them to look at me during dinner. I shouldn't have worn the shirt I had on. It was low cut, Scotty's favorite. I spent the whole meal hunched over my plate, embarrassed about myself and all the things I wasn't. After dinner, Scotty and I sat out on his back porch. His parents went to bed, and as soon as their bedroom light turned off, I breathed a sigh of relief. I felt like I was being graded. Hold this, Scotty said, handing me his cigarette. I have to pee. He smoked occasionally. I didn't mind it, but I didn't smoke. It was dark out, and he walked around to the side of the house. I was standing on his back porch, leaning against the railing, when his mother appeared at the back door. I straightened up and tried to hide the cigarette behind my back, but she'd already seen it. She walked away and then returned with a red Solo cup a moment later. "Use this for your ashes," she said, handing it to me out the back door. "We don't have an ashtray. None of us smoke." I was mortified, but all I could say was, "Thank you." And then I took the cup from her. She closed the back door just as Scotty came back for his cigarette. "Your mother hates me," I said, handing him the cigarette and the cup.
"No, she doesn't."
He kissed me on the forehead.
"The two of you will be best friends someday."
He took a final drag of his cigarette, and then I followed him back inside the house. He carried me up the stairs on his back. But when I saw all the pictures of him that lined the stairwell, I made him stop at each one so I could look at them. They were so happy. The way his mother looked at him in the photos is the same way she looked at him as an adult. "What kid is that cute?" I asked him. "They should have had 3 more of you."
"They tried," he said. "Apparently I was a miracle baby. Otherwise, they probably would have had 7 or 8.
That made me sad for Grace. We got to his room, and Scotty dropped me onto his bed. He said,
"You never talk about your family."
"I don't have one."
"What about your parents?"
"My father is somewhere. He got tired of paying child support, so he bolted. My mother and I don't get along. I haven't spoken to her in a couple of years."
"Why?"
"We just aren't compatible."
"What do you mean?"
Scotty sprawled out next to me on the bed. He seemed genuinely curious about my life, and I wanted to tell him the truth, but I also didn't want to scare him away. He grew up in such a normal household. I wasn't sure how he would feel knowing I didn't. "I was alone a lot," I said. "She always made sure I had food, but she neglected me to the point I was put in foster care 2. Both times they sent me back to live with her, though. It's like she was shitty, but not shitty enough. I think after growing up and seeing other families, I started to realize she wasn't a good mother, or even a good person. It became really hard to coexist. It was like she felt I was her competition and not on her team. It was exhausting. After I moved out, we stayed in touch for a while, but then she just stopped calling, and I stopped calling her. We haven't spoken in 2 years. I looked at Scotty, and he had the saddest look on his face. He didn't say anything. He just brushed my hair back and stayed quiet. "What was it like having a good family?" I asked him.
"I'm not sure I knew how good it was until just now,"
he replied. "Yes, you did. You love your parents. And this house. I can tell." He smiled gently.
"I don't know if I can explain it. But being here, it's like I can be my truest, most authentic self. I can cry. I can be in a bad mood or sad or happy. Any of those moods are accepted here. I don't feel that anywhere else."
The way he described it made me sad I never had it. "I don't know what that's like," I said. Scotty bent down and kissed my hand.
"I'll give it to you," he said. "We'll get a house together someday, and I'll let you pick everything out. You can paint it however you want. You can lock the door and only let the people in that you want in there. It'll be the most comfortable place you've ever lived."
I smiled. "That sounds like heaven." He kissed me then, made love to me, and as quiet as I tried to be, the house was even quieter. The next morning, when we were leaving, Scotty's mother couldn't look me in the eye. Her embarrassment seeped into me, and I knew for certain in that moment she didn't like me. As we were pulling out of his driveway, I pressed my forehead against the passenger window of Scotty's car. "That was mortifying. I think your mother heard us last night. Did you see how tense she was?"
"It's jarring for her," Scotty said. "She's my mother. She can't imagine me screwing any girl. It had nothing to do with you in particular.
I fell back against the seat and sighed. I liked your dad. Scotty laughed.
You'll love my mother, too. It's time we visit them. I'll make sure and fuck you before we get here so she can pretend I don't do things like that.
And maybe stop smoking? Scotty grabbed my hand.
I can do that. Next time, she'll love you so much she'll be pushing for a wedding and grandbabies.
Yeah, I said wistfully. Maybe. But I doubted it. Girls like me just didn't seem to fit in with any family.
Chapter 20. Ledger. It's been 3 days since she was in the bar, and 3 days since I was last in the grocery store. I told myself I wasn't going to come back here. I decided I'd just start shopping at Walmart again. But after having dinner with Diem last night, I spent the entire night thinking about Kenna. I've noticed since she's been back in town that the more time I spend with Diem, the more curious I am about Kenna. I compare Diem's mannerisms to hers now that I have something to compare them to. Even Diem's personality seems to make more sense now. Scotty was straightforward, concrete. He wasn't very imaginative, but I saw that as a good quality. He wanted to know how things worked, and he wanted to know why. He didn't waste time on anything that wasn't science-based. Diem is the opposite of that, and I've never wondered if she got that from her mother until now. Is Kenna concrete like Scotty was, or does she like to use her imagination? Is she artistic? Does she have dreams outside of being reunited with her daughter? More importantly, is she good? Scotty was good. I always assumed Kenna wasn't because of that one night, that one cause and effect, that one terrible choice she made. But what if we were just looking for someone to blame because we were all hurting so much? It never once occurred to me that Kenna might have been hurting as much as we were. I have so many questions for her. Questions I shouldn't want answers to, but I need to know more about that night and more about her intentions. I have a feeling she isn't going to leave town without a fight, and as much as Patrick and Grace want to brush this under the rug, it's not something that's going to go away. Maybe that's why I'm here, sitting in my truck, watching her load groceries into cars. I'm not sure if she's noticed I've been lurking in the parking lot for half an hour. She probably has. My truck doesn't necessarily blend in with its surroundings. There's a knock on my window that makes me jump. My eyes meet Grace's. She's holding Diem on her hip, so I open my door. What are you doing here? Grace shoots me a confused look. I'm sure she was expecting my response to be more on the excited side than concerned. We're getting groceries. We saw your truck. I want to go with you, Diem says. She reaches for me, and I slide out of the truck as I take her from Grace's arms. I immediately scan the parking lot to make sure Kenna isn't outside. You need to leave, I say to Grace. She parked in the row in front of me, so I walk toward her car. What's wrong? Grace asks. I face her and make sure to choose my words carefully. She works here. There's confusion in Grace's face before the realization hits. As soon as she grasps who I'm referring to, the color begins to drain from her cheeks. What? She's on shift right now. You need to get Diem out of here. But I want to go with you, Diem says. I'll come pick you up later, I say, gripping the door handle. Grace's car is locked. I wait for her to unlock it, but she's frozen in place like she's in a trance. Grace. She quickly refocuses and then starts digging in her purse for her keys. That's when I see Kenna. That's when Kenna sees me. Hurry, I say. My voice low. Grace's hands are shaking as she starts clicking her key fob. Kenna has stopped walking. She's just standing in the middle of the parking lot, staring at us. When she realizes what she's seeing, that her daughter is just yards from her, she abandons her customer's grocery cart and starts heading in our direction. Grace gets the doors unlocked, so I swing the back door open and put DM in her booster seat. I don't know why I feel like I'm racing against time. It's not like Kenna could take her with both of us right here. I just don't want Grace to have to face her, not in front of DM. This also isn't the time or the place for Kenna to meet her daughter for the first time. It would be too chaotic. It would scare DM.
Wait!
I hear Kenna yell. DM isn't even buckled in all the way when I say, go, and shut her door. Grace puts the car in reverse and pulls out of the parking spot as soon as Kenna reaches us. Kenna passes me and rushes after the car, and as much as I want to grab her and pull her back, I keep my hands off her because I still feel remorse for pulling her away from their front door. Kenna gets close enough to their car to tap the back of it and plead,
wait, Grace, wait, please.
Grace doesn't wait. She drives away, and it's painful to watch Kenna debate on running after the car. When she finally realizes she isn't going to stop them, she turns around and looks at me. Tears are streaming down her cheeks. She covers her mouth with her hands and starts to sob. It's conflicting, being thankful she didn't make it to us in time, but also heartbreaking for her that she didn't make it to us in time. I want Kenna to meet her daughter, but I don't want Diem to meet her mother, even though they're one and the same. I feel like Kenna's monster and Diem's protector. Kenna looks like she's about to collapse from agony. She's in no shape to finish her shift. I point to my truck. I'll give you a ride home. What's your boss's name? I'll let her know you aren't feeling well. She wipes her eyes with her hands and says, Amy, as she walks defeatedly toward my truck. I think I know the Amy she's referring to. I've seen her in the store before. The cart Kenna abandoned is still in the same spot. The elderly woman Kenna was walking groceries out for is just standing by her car, staring at Kenna as she climbs into my truck. She's probably wondering what in the hell all the commotion was. I run to the cart and push it over to the woman. Sorry about that. The woman nods and unlocks her trunk.
I hope she's okay.
She is. I load the groceries into her car and then return the cart to the store. I make my way to the customer service desk and find Amy behind the counter. I try to smile at her, but there's too much shifting around inside of me to even fake a smile at this point. Kenna isn't feeling well. I lie. I'm giving her a ride home. I just wanted to let you know.
Oh no, is she okay?
She will be. Do you know if she has anything I need to grab for her? Like a purse? Amy nods.
Yeah, she uses locker 12 in the break room.
She points to a door behind the customer service desk. I round the desk and walk through the door to the break room. The girl from Kenna's apartment complex is sitting at the table. She looks up at me, and I swear she scowls.
What are you doing in our break room, jerk?
I don't try to defend myself. She has her mind made up about me, and at this point, I agree with her. I open locker 12 and go to grab Kenna's purse. It's more like a tote bag, and the top is wide open, so I see a thick stack of pages shoved inside. It looks like a manuscript. I tell myself not to look, but my eyes unwittingly land on the first line on the front page. Dear Scotty. I want to read more, but I close the bag and respect her privacy. I go to leave the break room and say to the girl, Kenna is sick. I'm taking her home, but do you think you can check on her this evening? The girl's eyes are focused hard on me. She finally nods.
Okay, jerk.
I want to laugh, but there are too many things suppressing that laugh right now. When I get back to Amy, she says, let her know I clocked her out, and to call me if she needs anything. She has no phone, but I nod. I will. Thank you, Amy. When I reach the truck, Kenna is curled up in the passenger seat, facing more toward the window. She flinches when I open the door. I set the tote bag between us, and she pulls it to her side. She's still crying, but she doesn't say anything to me, so I don't say anything to her. I wouldn't even know what to say. I'm sorry. Are you okay? I'm an asshole. I pull out of the parking lot and don't even make it half a mile down the road when Kenna mutters something that sounds like, pull over. I look at her, but she's looking out the window. When I don't put on my blinker, she repeats herself. Pull over. Her voice is demanding now. You'll be home in 2 minutes.
Pull over!
I don't say anything else. I do what she says. I flip on my blinker and pull over to the shoulder. She grabs her tote bag, gets out of the truck, and then slams the door. She starts walking in the direction of her apartment. When she gets several feet in front of my truck, I put it in drive and move along the shoulder, rolling down my window. Kenna, get back in the truck. She keeps walking.
You told her to leave. You saw me coming, and you told her to leave. Why do you keep doing this to me?
I continue driving at the pace she's walking until she finally turns and faces me through the window.
Why?
She demands. I press on the brakes until we're even. My hands are starting to shake. Maybe it's the adrenaline. Maybe it's the guilt. Maybe it's the anger. I put my truck in park because she looks like she's ready to tackle this. Do you really think you can confront Grace in the parking lot of a grocery store?
Well, I tried to do it at their house, but we both know how that turned out.
I shake my head. The location isn't what I'm referring to. I don't know what I'm referring to. I work to gather my thoughts. I'm confused because I think she might be right. She tried to approach them peacefully the first time, and I stopped her then too. They aren't strong enough for whatever it is you're here for, even if you aren't here to take her from them. They aren't even strong enough to share her with you. They've given DM a good life, Kenna. She's happy, and she's safe. Is that not enough? Kenna looks like she's holding her breath, but her chest is heaving. She stares at me for a moment, and then walks toward the back of the truck so that I can't see her face. She stands still for a while, but then she walks into the grass on the side of the road and just sits down. She pulls up her knees and hugs them as she stares out over an empty field. I don't know what she's doing, or if she needs time to think. I give her a few minutes alone, but she doesn't move or stand up, so I finally get out of the truck. When I reach her, I don't say anything. I quietly sit down next to her. The traffic and the world continue to move behind us, but in front of us is a big, open field, so we both stare straight ahead and not at each other. She eventually looks down and pulls a small yellow flower out of the grass. She rolls it in her fingers, and I find myself watching her now. She inhales a slow breath, but doesn't look at me when she releases it and starts to speak.
Other mothers told me what it would be like, she says.
They told me they'd take me to the hospital to give birth, and that I'd get 2 days with her.
2 whole days. Just me and her.
A tear falls down her cheek. I can't tell you how much I looked forward to those 2 days. It was the only thing I had to look forward to. But she was born early. I don't know if you know that, but she was a preemie. 6 weeks. Her lungs were... Kenna blows out of breath. Right after she was delivered, they had to transfer her to the NICU at another hospital. I spent my 2 days alone in a recovery room with an armed guard keeping watch over me. And when my 2 days were up, they sent me back to the prison. I never got to hold her. I never even got to look into the eyes of the human Scotty and I made. Kenna, don't. Whatever you're about to say, don't. Trust me. I'd be lying if I said I didn't come here with the ridiculous hope that I would be welcomed into her life and even given some kind of role. But I also know she's where she belongs. So I would have been grateful for anything. I would have been so grateful to finally get to look at her, even if that's all I was ever allowed to do. Whether you or Scotty's parents think I deserve that or not. I close my eyes because her voice is painful enough. Looking at her and seeing the agony on her face when she talks makes it so much worse. I am so grateful to them, she says. You have no idea. The whole time I was pregnant, I never had to worry about what kind of people would raise her. They were the same two people who raised Scotty, and he was perfect. She's quiet for a couple of seconds, so I open my eyes. She's staring right at me when she shakes her head and says, I'm not a bad person, Ledger. Her voice is full of so much regret. I'm not here because I think I deserve her. I just wanted to see her. That's all. That's it. She uses her shirt to dry her eyes, and then she says, Sometimes I wonder what Scotty would think if he could see us. It makes me hope that an afterlife doesn't exist, because if it does, Scotty is probably the only sad person in heaven. Those words hit me in the gut, because I'm terrified she might be right. It's been my biggest fear since she showed back up and I started viewing her as the woman Scotty was in love with, rather than the woman who left him to die. I stand up and leave Kenna alone in the grass. I walk to my truck and open my console. I get my phone and take it back to where Kenna is sitting. I sit down next to her again and open my photo app, and then open the folder where I keep all the videos I've taken of Diem. I pull up the most recent one I took of her at dinner last night, and I hit play and hand the phone to Kenna. I never could have imagined what it would be like for a mother to lay eyes on her child for the first time. The sight of Diem on the screen steals Kenna's breath. She slaps a hand over her mouth and begins to cry. She cries so hard, she has to set the phone on her legs so she can use her shirt to clear her eyes of tears. Kenna becomes a different person, right in front of my eyes. It's as if I'm witnessing her become a mother. It might be the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. I feel like an absolute fucking monster for not helping her experience this moment sooner. I'm sorry, Scotty. She watched 4 videos while sitting in the grass on the side of the road. She cried the whole time, but she also smiled a lot, and she laughed every time Diem would speak. I let her hold my phone and continue to watch more of them as I drove her home. I walked her upstairs to her apartment because I would have felt too bad taking my phone away from her, so so she's been watching videos for almost an entire hour. Her emotions are all over the place. She's laughing, she's crying, she's happy, she's sad. I have no idea how I'll get my phone back. I don't know that I want to. I've been in her apartment for so long, Kenna's kitten is now asleep in my lap. I'm on one end of the couch and Kenna is on the other, and I'm just watching her watch the videos of Diem, full of pride like a father. Because I know Diem is healthy and articulate and funny and happy, and it feels good to watch Kenna realize all these things about her daughter. But at the same time, I feel like I'm betraying two of the most important people in my life. If Patrick and Grace knew I was here right now, showing Kenna videos of the child they've raised, they'd likely never speak to me again. I wouldn't blame them. There's just no way to navigate this situation in a way that I don't feel like I'm betraying someone. I'm betraying Kenna by keeping Diem from her. I'm betraying Patrick and Grace by giving Kenna a glimpse of Diem. I'm even betraying Scotty, although I don't quite know how yet. I'm still trying to figure out where those feelings of guilt are coming from.
She's so happy, Kenna says.
I nod. She is. She's very happy. Kenna looks up at me, wiping her eyes with a crumpled-up napkin I handed her in the truck.
Does she ever ask about me?
Not specifically, but she is starting to wonder where she came from. Last weekend, she asked if she grew in a tree or in an egg. Kenna smiles. She's still young enough that she doesn't really understand family dynamics. She has me and Patrick and Grace, so right now I don't know that she really feels like anyone is missing. I don't know if that's what you want to hear. It's just the truth. Kenna shakes her head.
It's fine. It actually makes me feel good that she doesn't know I'm missing in her life yet.
She watches another video, and then reluctantly hands me the phone. She pushes off the couch to walk to her bathroom.
Please don't leave yet.
I nod, assuring her I'm not going anywhere. When she closes the bathroom door, I move Kenna's kitten and stand up. I need something to drink. The last couple of hours have somehow made me feel dehydrated, even though Kenna is the one who has been crying. I open Kenna's refrigerator, but it's empty. Completely empty. I open her freezer, and it's empty too. When she steps out of her bathroom, I'm looking through her empty cabinets. They're as barren as her apartment.
I don't have anything yet. I'm sorry.
She seems embarrassed when she says that.
It's just, it took everything I had to move here. I'll get paid soon, and I plan to move eventually to somewhere better, and I'm getting a phone, and
I lift a hand when I realize she thinks I'm judging her ability to provide for herself, or maybe for Diem.
Kenna.